I have a special treat for you this morning. I couldn't say anything about this because we weren't sure if it was going to happen or not, but I am happy to welcome to the guest line here a man who I have been going to see in concert for almost a quarter of a century and who I'm looking forward to seeing on stage again tonight at the Kiel Center. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Big 550 KTRS, Billy Joel. Good morning, Billy. How are you?
Good morning, Paul. I'm fine. How are you?
Good. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you.
The last time I saw you was at a concert where you allowed me to bring a whole bunch of my listeners to one of your sound checks in the afternoon.
Oh, yeah.
And you and the band, you know, you rock on stage, I guess, for about an hour, so your sound and lights guys can make sure that they've got everything right. And what stunned me that day was that you didn't do a single Billy Joel song during the sound check.
No. No, we usually do, the Beatles or Led Zeppelin or Hendrix or Cream or Otis Redding or anything but Billy Joel songs.
Why is that?
Just to drive the sound and light guy crazy. Because they want us to do our own stuff so they can, you know, get a sound and see what the lights are going to look like. But, you see, we do these Billy Joel songs every night.
Right.
And musicians are very superstitious. I don't know if you've talked to a lot of musicians about all these crazy superstitions we got. One of the superstitions is that if you have a good sound check and your stuff sounds good at the sound check, it's going to sound lousy during the real show.
Really?
Yeah. So in other words, good sound check, bad show.
Hmm.
So what you want to do is have a bad sound check. You see?
Yeah.
That's why they say break a leg before you go on.
Right. And when I saw you that time, you were playing a lot of Clapton stuff, Cream, Blind Faith, solo Clapton. This is the music that you grew up listening to on the radio, right?
Yeah, I liked rock in the 60s. I did.
What was the first rock and roll record you owned?
The first rock and roll record I ever went out and got and bought, paid for?
Yeah.
Oh, man. It had to be before the Beatles. I remember the Beatles was the first album.
Which album was it, do you know?
The Meet the Beatles.
Very first one.
Yeah, it was the first one that I bought. Now, as far as a 45, well, it had to be, oh, boy. Well, what the heck that would that have been? That's a good question. My first 45. We were dancing a lot back in those days. Pre-Beatles, there was a lot of slow dancing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was maybe would it have been Freddie Scott? Would he predate the Beatles? Hey, girl.
That sounds like about 59 or so. Yeah, so 60 around there.
I think early 60s. Freddie Scott did a song called "Hey Girl." As a matter of fact, I even covered it on one of these greatest hits packages that they put out.
Yeah.
And because I remember it was like one of my earliest girlfriends, and that's she was leaving for the summer, and I was thinking, and my heart was breaking. I was about 14. Hey, girl.
Yeah.
I'm going to miss you so much when you go. I said, I got to get that, and I was going to play it for her and make her change her mind, but it didn't work.
Well, you said that one of the reasons that you started playing rock and roll was to get girls, right?
What do you mean one of the reasons? How about the reason? It wasn't to, you know, not so much like get girls, but to meet girls, because some guys have the gift of, you know, the smooth talking. Some guys have the clothes. Some guys have the car. Some guys are just great looking. I didn't have any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. All I had was I knew how to play the piano.
Yeah.
And I realized when I was still a little boy, when I'd play the piano, little girls would come over and listen. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this might come in handy in the future.
And it has.
Yeah, I mean, it's really not the only reason. I mean, I love music. I love music ever since I was a child. But I guess to get up on a stage, really, is that would probably be the main reason, to get up there and jump around and sing and yell your head off and make a fool out of yourself. Of course it was to meet girls.
Yeah.
It wasn't to impress guys.
And there are, I'm sure, times you're on stage where you're thinking, I'm getting paid for this, and look at all the girls who are watching me.
Well, that was the first gig that we ever did. I was in a band. I was about 14 years old. It was in a church. We got up on a stage, we played a bunch of Beatles songs and early Stones songs, and this girl that I had a crush on was actually looking at me. She never looked at me before. She was looking at me. I said, oh, wow, this is really cool. And I thought the music we were playing sounded great. I loved the songs. We were having a great time. At the end of the night, the priest comes over and gives us something like $15 a piece. This is back in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
Now, $15 in 1964 is like, what, $1,500 now?
Yeah.
And I said, you mean you get paid for this? So that was it. I knew what I was going to do right then at that moment.
Now, we've all heard tales of rock stars and groupies, and you've been married twice, but there, I'm sure, have been times when you've been on stage and your music has attracted adult women to you as an adult man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does that still happen to you now that you're a single guy? I know you've got a girlfriend now, but does that still happen where women are still coming on to you? Oh, Billy, I want you. Does that still happen?
I hope so. Yeah.
Do they get through to you? I'm not asking if you're going to bed with them, but I mean, at the point where you are in your life, this is, you say this is your last tour, you're 50 years old, you've got a girlfriend, you've been married twice, you've got a daughter. Do you have people who say...
No, I'm not dead, man.
No, but I mean, you know, a lot of bands had guys who were purposely saying, bring those women backstage.
We don't do that.
Don't do
but
that.
But if you see somebody and you're attracted to them and they're attracted to you, there's ways to meet people, sure.
Mm-hmm.
We probably meet more people traveling than we do actually at the gig. We don't usually put the first couple of rows on sale. About 15, 20 years ago, I got so sick and tired looking down the front rows and just seeing all these, you know, fat cats, rich people who bought tickets from scalpers because the scalpers always got the front row seats and sold them for a lot of money to rich people,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of cut the real fans out from being able to get close to the stage.
Right.
And these people paid so much money for the front row tickets, they didn't even get up. They wouldn't jump around. They weren't enthusiastic. They would just kind of sit there like, okay, entertain me, piano man. And we would be looking at each other like, this stinks. And you knew all the real fans were in the back, and they always got gypped out of the good seats. So I said, that's it. We're not putting the front row seats on sale anymore. We're going to hold the tickets for the front row seats. So we give them the tickets to the front row to the guys in the road crew and send the guys in the road crew out before the evening started to the kids in the back in the worst seats and give them the front row seats.
Wow.
Now, most of the people in the road crew are guys. And guys end up doing? Well, they got good tickets to the front row. Who do they give the tickets to?
Great-looking girls.
Cute girls.
Yeah.
Now, sorry, that may sound, you know, sexist, whatever it is. That's the way life works.
Yeah.
And that's they give these tickets to the girls. And then in the front row, we'll look down and see all these great-looking girls. And we'll think, my, this is a terrific-looking audience. You know, and let me tell you something, it don't hurt the show, neither.
Yeah, I bet it doesn't.
No, when you think you're playing, you know, all these cute girls, and hey, man, you play a lot better. Now, I'm on tour with Elton John, and we talk Elton into the thing of don't put the first couple of rows on sale. And he says, great idea. The fans, that way the fans will get the good seats, and we'll bring the fans up to the front row. Now, he's watching my side of the stage, and he sees all these cute girls. And I see a little light bulb go off over his head one night. And then from then on, there's all these cute boys in front of him. And let me tell you something. His show got better, too.
Is that right?
Yep. So it works. You know,
yeah.
But if you let the real fans get the good seats up front, it just makes for a better show. And, yes, it's fun to flirt on stage, of course. Yeah, sure.
When you're looking down at that front row, since those are the hardcore Billy Joel fans now, do you see them singing the lyrics to your songs?
Oh, yeah.
And knowing them better than you do sometimes? Because you've actually got a monitor on stage, right? Or a book in front of you just in case?
I brought a book. I used to bring a book with me. Now they have teleprompters, but it's, I don't know. The book is sort of like a psychological Linus' security blanket. Like, I just like to know the lyrics are nearby because I've written so many songs, I'm starting to worry that I'm going to forget them.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't want to just sit there and read the teleprompter like I'm watching TV. That's no fun either.
Right.
So a lot of times I'll look down and I'll see the people in the first couple of rows that I can see their mouths moving. They're singing the words. And let me tell you, some nights they're a lifeline, man. I'm just watching like in a song like We Didn't Start the Fire where there's 10 million words, bang, bang, bang.
Right.
I'm watching and I'm trying to find the kid who knows all the words by heart, and you can usually tell because they're looking at you like, I know. I know the words. Watch me, Billy. Trust me. And that's what I do, and I follow them sometimes. I can't follow my drummer anymore. I used to follow him, but now he just does things to mess me up.
Now, what's going to happen at Liberty and the best rest of the boys when you finish up this tour, which you say is the last time you're going to go put on a grand-scale tour like this? What are they going to go do?
Well, they've all been doing other things for a while anyway. A number of them are working with other bands. Let's see. A couple of the people in the band have been working with Enrique Iglesias. Crystal's been working with Garth Brooks. Liberty's been doing a thing with the Hard Rock Cafe people. Mark Rivera does a lot of work up in New York, session work. A couple of the people live in Nashville, and there's always all kinds of music things going on in Nashville. And my road crew, boy, they're always working. I mean, they just finished doing the Springsteen tour, most of the guys on my crew.
Mm-hmm.
And so when Bruce is off the road, I'm usually on the road. That's the way it works. What else is going on? Boy, my sound guy, he's doing everybody. He just finished doing Mellencamp and Bob Dylan and Paul Simon. And
in the meantime, you're finishing up this last time around in arenas and working on classical stuff at the same time, right? That's your new avocation?
Well, for the last couple of years, that's what I've been writing. I really haven't written any new songs since The River of Dreams. The last song I wrote was called Famous Last Words, and the line in that song says, "These are the last words I have to say," and that's the last song I actually wrote. And since then, it's been classical piano pieces. And, you know, I don't want anybody to get scared coming to the show. Oh, boy, you're going to dump all this new classical piano pieces on us, because we're gonna do the rock and roll stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I am having these pieces recorded by another pianist. I'm not good enough to play these things. I can write them, but I'm not a good enough accomplished pianist to play them the way they should be played. But eventually, hopefully, early in this coming millennium,
mm-hmm.
There will be some kind of recording that I can present to the public.
You know, your rock records have always been so cinematic. You're telling stories, and the characters are so vibrant in the songs. Was making videos of those songs fun for you, or were they a struggle?
Oh, no, I hate videos. I hated them.
Why?
Well, I don't think I'm photogenic in the first place. I'm camera shy. I got into music mainly because it wasn't visual. Music was something you heard, not something you saw. Didn't really ever like the way TV treated music. TV always kind of trivialized music, like they wouldn't show Elvis from the waist down,
mm-hmm.
you know, but you could hear it in the record.
Right.
And I don't know, it's sort of like painting a mustache on your own painting that you've already finished. I'm not a big fan of videos, and I've always said that from the beginning. I understand that they're a promotional tool, and okay, people like to see the artist, and that's fine, but some of these videos I'm watching where they got, you know, bats flying through the air, and, you know, garter belts and people being whipped and Marilyn Manson. I said, wait a minute, what am I listening to?
Mm-hmm.
Am I watching or am I listening? And actually, it's more watching than listening.
Mm-hmm.
But some people dig it, and that's cool. If you dig it, that's great. Whatever floats your boat, it's just not for me.
Speaking of the visual medium, has anybody ever approached you to score a movie? I know you've written songs here and there for movies at times, but has anybody ever said, you know, Billy, I'd like you to do the music for this entire movie?
Well, there were a couple of projects that came, but never came to fruition. There was going to be a movie made about the commercial fishermen from my neck of the woods, which is Long Island, but the movie never went into production. Then there was this movie which is just being wrapped with George Clooney and Mark Wahlberg called The Perfect Storm, which is a wonderful book. It's probably going to be a great movie. And I would like to have had a shot at writing the score for that, but they got Paul Horner, I think, James Horner, who did Titanic,
mm-hmm.
and who, you know, very well-known and very successful scoring composer. So I don't know, maybe one of these days. But you know what? I'm having fun just writing the music for its own sake and not having it to be connected to anything.
When we come to the Kiel Center tonight to see you, there will be no opening act, as always.
No, the opening act will be us waiting for the audience to get away from the traffic jam.
Why don't you have an opening act? And all the times I've seen you, I can't recall, unless it was sometime in the 70s, I can't recall you ever having an opening act. Why not?
Well, I think there's only so much time during the evening that people are going to be in the venue. We're trying to cover something like, I don't know, 16 albums worth of material. And the opening act, they don't really, the audience doesn't seem to have a whole lot of patience for an opening act.
They kind of exist to get booed off the stage, don't they?
Well, we used to be an opening act, and I used to open up for the Beach Boys, and man, it was not pleasant. You know, they didn't want to hear, oh, Billy Joel, his little piano man song. Get off the stage, Beach Boys, Beach Boys, Beach Boys, Beach Boys. We opened up for the Doobie Brothers. We opened up for Yes. We opened up for the Eagles, Linda Ronstadt. What's her name? One with the three first names. Olivia Newton-John. Don't ask me how I got on that tour.
Wow.
It was like Lenny Bruce and Snow White. That was a very strange tour. We opened up for Hall & Oates. We opened up for everybody. And then we got kicked off all the tours because we were starting to get too good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we figured, you know what, why don't we just do our own show? That's mostly what people come there to see anyway. They want to see as much material as we can give them. And it sure makes it a lot easier on the road crew not to have to move a lot of equipment around once we're set up.
Right, right.
So,
since you've been on stage so much, do you ever go to concerts to see other people? And what was the best concert you ever saw somebody else do?
Best concert I ever saw, I think, must have been Jimi Hendrix, 1968. It used to be called the Singer Bowl, and now it's called, it's where they have the U.S. Open.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's the U.S. Tennis Stadium or something.
Forest Hills Tennis Stadium, whatever that is.
Yeah, I saw Hendrix there in 68, and it just blew me away. Oh, there's that other line again.
Do I have to let you go, or do I have a few more minutes?
No, if I could put you on hold.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
That's all right. It's the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris. We're talking to Billy Joel, who's in his hotel room now. Getting ready to hit the stage of the Kiel Center, and as you heard him say, there's no opening act. He comes out, and you know, I can say this while I'm on hold. And
hi.
I was just going to say while I was kind of stalling while you're waiting for you to come back. I was just going to say that a lot of people who have never seen you in concert, who finally do come to see you, will be surprised by what a rock and roll show you put on, and this is their last chance to see that tonight. And I know there are a few seats that are still available, so I was just pimping for your concert for a moment while you were gone.
Oh well, thank you for
You're welcome.
You know, I guess if people only know me from the songs that are the top 40 hits, I guess there were a good amount of ballads that ended up being hits. I don't pick them; the record company is the one that picks them. But we've recorded a lot of rock and roll music that never got played on top 40 radio or that never received a whole lot of airplay that is, rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people are always surprised, oh, gee, we thought he was going to be this kind of mushy, soft rock guy. And yeah, okay, I wrote a ballad here and there. So did the Beatles.
Yep.
But they wrote a lot of rock and roll songs, too. So I like it all. I like everything.
Since you mentioned you got 16 albums to choose from, are there songs that you're going to be playing on this tour and tonight that we have not heard you play on stage in a long time?
Well, I know of at least one that we've never done, which is called 2,000 Years, which seems kind of appropriate to do now.
Mm-hmm.
Especially since I think that's the name of this tour, the 2,000 Years Tour. I don't know, why do they got to give tours names?
I don't know.
Billy Joel, the 2,000 Years Tour.
Oh, if it was just Billy Joel, I wouldn't go, but if it's the 2,000 Years Tour.
That's all this thing. So, we'll be doing that song. I'm trying to think, what else? Some obscurities. I don't know. We haven't really sat down and figured out what might be the set list tonight. So
you're not doing the same show every night in every venue?
Oh, no. We're changing the show every night. Matter of fact, I started doing a song we haven't done for about 5 years now called Uptown Girl. You remember that one?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, well, I didn't want to do that one for a long time.
I can't understand why.
Gee, why not?
Yeah.
So I took it out again. You know, I'm having fun doing it. I'm kind of over that. And there are songs we haven't done in a long time, songs people may not be familiar with.
And the converse, of course, is, are there songs that you say to yourself, you know what, I just don't want to do that song, like Uptown Girl you stopped doing for a while, but are there songs now where you say, okay, I don't want to do that, or the band comes to you and say, Billy, please don't make us do that song again?
Well, we have had that happen with songs where we put them away, like Uptown Girl, and then you take them out, and you kind of dust them off, you know, and you iron them up, and you go, oh, this isn't that bad, this still fits, you
mm-hmm.
know, all right, let's wear this one.
Mm-hmm.
So no, we're not at a point where we're doing something that we're sick of. And actually, this is a very short tour we're doing. The first date was December 2nd in New Orleans, and the last date before Christmas will be the 21st. And then we're going to do New Year's Eve at Madison Square Garden in New York. And that's it. I mean, so this is a little mini, sissy, puny tour.
Right.
This isn't even a rehearsal. Most people, we'll say, okay, we're doing a 9-10 city tour. Big deal. We do tours for like a year and a half, 2 years.
Yeah.
But this one, we're having a lot of fun, probably just because it's such a small tour.
And when you're out on tour like this and you're staying in whatever fancy hotels you're staying in around the world, I'm sure that there are times when you go downstairs to get something to eat and there's a guy playing the piano, and I'm sure you've walked in and heard them playing a Billy Joel song, and you went, okay, let's not go in here, or do you want to go in and see the guy do your stuff?
Well, once you're in, you're in. I mean, if I walk out when he starts playing, that would really make, I would really look like a creep, wouldn't I?
Yeah, you would.
He walked out, the guy was playing his stuff, and he just walked right out. What a bum.
Yeah.
So, no, I wouldn't do that. But sometimes the sheet music, I think it's for Just the Way You Are, is wrong. The opening chords are printed out wrong. It's supposed to be a suspension. Musicians will understand this. And they have it printed out as two separate chords. Da-da-da-da. Da 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 da. In the sheet music, they have two separate chords. Da da. It's supposed to be a suspension. Da, da. Anyway, so all you guys out there who are piano players who have the sheet music, please make that correction. Thank you very much.
And stop playing it wrong in the piano bars.
Well, they're not playing it wrong according to the music, but they're playing it wrong according to how I wrote it.
Yeah.
But no, I don't mind that. I think it's fun. You know, that guy, he's got to be there every night banging away. And a lot of times people aren't even paying attention to him. I've done that gig, and I know how tough it is. And if I'm there and you know, go over and say hi and talk to him and, you know, and just give him a smile, I mean, it makes a guy feel good. Hey, what's wrong with that?
Mm-hmm. You ever put a dollar in the tip jar?
I can't put a dollar in. I got to leave a 10 or a 5. You know, otherwise, I'm a cheapskate.
Yeah, look at Billy Joel, Mr. Rock and Roll Star, gives me a dollar.
Exactly.
Yeah. Were there guys who ever tipped you heavily when you were doing that yourself?
Not that heavily.
No?
No, no. I only did it for about 6 months. Some people think I did this for years and years. I only did it for a couple of months while I was hiding out in Los Angeles trying to get out of a bad recording contract.
I guess you wouldn't want to sneak into a piano bar and just do that every once in a while now, especially since you've got big stages to play on.
Oh, no, we do that all the time. Sometimes we're in a town or in a club. I'll just sneak on stage and start playing, put on a pair of shades and a hat and just kind of play the Hammond organ or play some blues piano. I like to do stuff like that. Matter of fact, where were we the other night? I think it was Kansas City. We were just playing Christmas carols for the whole bar all night.
Wow.
Yeah, and then the security lady came and threw us out. She said, you're making too much noise. You're not allowed to play the piano if you're not in the union.
Really?
Yeah, and I said, excuse me, I'm in Local 802, AFFM, lady.
Yeah, excuse me. And I'm sure the guy who's running the place or whoever's in there is going, don't you know who that is?
I think they said something the next day, like, we're so sorry. I said, hey, that's cool. You got rules. There were probably people upstairs going, well, you tell those idiots downstairs to shut up? We can't sleep.
That guy pretending to be Billy Joel downstairs. Yeah. Man. Oh, God. Does Alexa ever go out on tour with you?
When I'm touring in the summertime, which is very rare anymore, she would come out on the road, and sometimes when she'd be on like a spring break, if I was working, which I think we did on the earlier this year, she had a spring break with me, and we were in Florida, and she liked that. That was fun for her, and she'll be with me at New Year's.
That'll be nice. Does she have any musical talent? Is she following in Dad's footsteps?
Oh, she's very talented. She plays the piano. She has a beautiful singing voice, very strong voice. She has perfect pitch, instant melody retention. Her sight reading on the piano is getting very good. She's playing Chopin and Mozart, and I'm very proud of her.
Does she play any of Daddy's music?
No.
Would you encourage her to go into the business?
I would encourage her to do whatever whatever her heart's desire is to do, I would support her. But I would just, stress that, look, if you're going to do it really well.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it halfway. Practice, practice, practice. Be really good at it. And do what, I always tell everybody that, do what you love, because then you'll always love what you do.
And certainly make better business decisions than Daddy did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd get her a good lawyer right off
the bat. I once asked you what you thought about lawyers, and you told me you can sort of see the smell in the room change a little bit when a whole bunch of lawyers come in, because you've had bad experiences with them through the years, I know.
Well, look, there are good lawyers, there are ambulance chasers, and hopefully you get a good one. But I tell people, look, when you start making money, get yourself a lawyer. And then when you make a little more money, you hire another lawyer, look after the first lawyer.
Billy, I saw you on the thing with James Lipton on Bravo a couple of weeks ago, the Inside the Actors Studio. They gave you a whole two-hour show, and you did it a whole evening. And I've heard some of the Q&A stuff that you've done. In fact, on one of your greatest hits, Box Sets, there's a one disc of you answering questions from the audience and talking about that sort of stuff. And it's occurred to me, you'd be a terrific teacher. Have you ever considered doing that, like after you finish touring, taking a position at some college and just teaching for a while?
Well, I don't know if I would want to do it at just one college. I actually travel around. I've been doing this for close to 20 years now, where I go and I do master classes at places like Columbia, Princeton, or I've been to Oxford, I've been to Yale, Harvard. It's a lot of fun. I don't know if I'd want to be a professor in residence, because where I live, let's see, there's not that many big colleges nearby. But I do like doing it from time to time, and that's something I'll probably continue to do even if I'm not touring, just doing these master classes. I mix in a little music, and I end up telling some funny stories because I have an extremely funny job. I mean, this job is hysterical.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best job I ever had, but it's very, very funny. And also trying to pass along some helpful information to people who may be considering careers in the entertainment industry.
And do you teach them about other music, or is it all about Billy Joel?
It's well, a lot of times it's about other music. I would prefer to talk to students at colleges, because the questions tend to be more academic and technical rather than Billy Joel fan questions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk about other music. I mean, how music gets composed, like Beethoven and Mozart and Chopin and Rachmaninoff and Gershwin, or Lennon and McCartney, or you know, Cole Porter, anything like that. There's a lot of craft that goes along with the job that people who are just starting out, they really need to know. They need to know how you do these things. How do you write? How do you form songs? How do you record songs? How do you market songs? Questions about the music business. How do you tour? How do you perform? How do you set up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of information that needs to be known. It's not as simple as it appears. And I like to be able to help people, because when I was starting out, nobody was giving me this information. I had to find it out the hard way.
Have you had some of these young people who you've been talking to at these events come up and hand you a tape and say, oh, please listen to this, and have you actually listened?
I won't take tapes because I've been sued.
Mm.
In other words, somebody hands me a tape, and I go, oh, okay, I'll listen to it, and it has the word "the" on it. And then if I write a song that has the word "the" in it, I get a letter from a lawyer that says, you stole a lyric from my client, and I've actually got to go and fight this kind of absurdity.
Right.
So I've actually stopped taking tapes. As much as I'd like to help people, I just won't take tapes anymore. That's another reason I stopped writing songs. I got sick of the lawsuits.
Mm.
But if somebody is in the audience and they want to play a song at that particular moment, I'd say, sure, go right ahead. Let them come up and play, you know. Go ahead, stand or fall, you know, on your own.
What songs have you been sued over?
Oh, let's see. Somebody said I stole We Didn't Start the Fire. And then they said I stole River of Dreams and made both songs out of one song that he wrote. I mean, this is how absurd it is. First they said that I stole We Didn't Start the Fire, which really I wouldn't claim the melody of anyway, because there's no melody. And then the River of Dreams, which has three chords, which is sort of like an old-fashioned song. He said I stole In the Middle of the Night. The phrase In the Middle of the Night, I stole from him. Like, he was the first person in history who ever said the phrase In the Middle of the Night. You know, and I called my lawyer. I said, didn't these guys ever hear of, like, Shakespeare?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure he said that somewhere.
I'm sure.
But they let these lawsuits stand in court, and they're frivolous. And I think we should go back to the English system. If you're going to sue me, and you think you're going to get money out of me, and you lose, then you got to pay me, baby.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the way it should be, because there's too much of that going on.
Have you ever listened to somebody else's song and said, hold on just a second, now that's definitely my record, and you're just taking it and changing it and calling it yours?
Well, actually, I have. I don't want to mention any names, but I have heard other songs that reminded me of something I wrote, but I didn't sue them because, I don't know, maybe they did it unconsciously, and maybe it's not that big a deal, and I don't think, maybe I didn't have the original idea in the first place. Anyway, I'm sure somebody like Schumann or Schubert or Beethoven or Mozart probably wrote that melody before I did anyway. As a matter of fact, I was listening to Uptown Girl the other day on the radio. I was listening to a classical station, and I heard a Mozart piece. And it was played on a piano, and I went, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da- can't get up out of the grave and come after me.
Right.
And the rest of the song was different. But, you know, look, it's all been done one way or the other before.
And didn't you have a friend who you were writing a song and you played an ending for him and he said that was some classical composer and you couldn't do it?
Yes, that was a song called Lullaby, which was on the last album.
Beautiful song.
Thank you. Yeah, when I was originally writing it, it was before I had the words, I had an ending that was very similar to a composer named Edvard Grieg, who wrote some beautiful music. And I said, oh, yeah, but it works perfectly for this piece. And he goes, yeah, but it's Grieg. And I said, ah, so it's Grieg. You know, who's going to know? It's Grieg. Grieg's dead. You know. He goes, yeah, but now you know. And I said, damn it, you're right. Now I know. You know, and why did you tell me?
Yeah.
Because now that I know, I have to change it. I actually came up with an ending that I liked better anyway.
And have there been times where you've been writing a song, and I know you haven't written any rock records for 5 or 6 years now, but where you were writing a song and you said, I think I did this before, or here's an old piece that I'm going to revive that I never used in another song, and I'm going to stick it in here.
Well, I do have what I call a spare parts bin. There are little pieces of music that don't end up being used in a song that I kind of keep in a memory bank.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like, you know, working on an old car. Well, let's try this carburetor. This might work. Yeah, there we go. Up, there's an exhaust manifold. Let's see if that'll fit on this engine block. Yep, there. Look at that. So I have a spare parts bin, and there are little fragments of music running around in my head all the time, even when I'm sleeping.
Have you ever had that Keith Richards wake up in the middle of the night, come up with a chord and fall back asleep kind of thing?
Yes, and then you forget it. I hate that. A lot of times I'll dream a song and it's perfect. It's great. And I'll wake up and say it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I say, this is fantastic, and it's so good, I know I won't forget it. Then I go back to sleep and I wake up in the morning and go, oh, what was that thing? Oh, what was that thing? What was that thing? It was great. It was great. And then you forget it. But then a couple of weeks later, it pops back into your head.
Uh-huh.
And then you sit there and start writing, and you go, where have I heard this before? This is great, but somebody, I think I've heard this before. And you know what? Yeah, you heard it before. You heard it in your dream. This happens all the time.
And how about the band contributing to when you were writing songs? When you'd go in the studio with them and you'd play a new song for them, would they contribute by saying, let's change the beat on this? Or what about a guitar riff?
There's my other line again. I don't believe this.
All right.
I'm sorry. Can you hold?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
It's all right. It's the Big 550 KTRS. It gives me a chance to identify the station. It's nice. And I know I got commercials, but I got Billy Joel on the line here, so we're going to push the commercials back. Hi, Billy. How are you?
I'm good. You know what? I've got so many backlog calls now.
Okay.
I'm going to have to jump off.
I appreciate you taking the time to do this. I know it was a last-minute deal, and it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you, Paul.
Okay, Billy. Take care.
We'll see you.
There's Billy Joel live at his hotel downtown somewhere. I just want to take a moment here to thank my producer, Lauren Ryan, who worked her butt off to make this happen. And it literally happened just before I came on the air today. And Billy said, sure, I'll call in. I haven't talked to him in a while, so that was nice. And it has been about 5 years since I've had a chance to chat with him. So there you go, an exclusive on the Big 550 KTRS, Billy Joel here on the Paul Harris Show.